complicated because this goes beyond the permitting decision that the Corps makes about whether Pebble can get a permit.
What does the EPA's veto of the proposed Pebble mine really mean? Well, we will discuss. Because from Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 1st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, investigators use genetic genealogy to identify human remains found 25 years ago.
Gary was dropped off in and around the area where the remains were found.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you an Alaska artist or do you know one? March 1st is the deadline to apply for a Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Award. The program provides awards to artists, musicians, performers, writers, and culture bearers. Amounts are increasing. A project award, now $10,000, is available for an Alaska artist at any career stage. Mid-career and established artists may apply for a $25,000 artist fellowship. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. Rasmussen Foundation, promoting a better life for all Alaskans. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The Bureau of Land Management is inclined to allow ConocoPhillips to develop Willow, the company's proposal for oil drilling on federal land in the Arctic near the village of Nuiqsut. The agency suggests trimming the proposal to 219 wells, some 32 fewer than the company asked for. The recommendations are in a planning document called a Final Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement that the BLM announced today. The BLM's parent agency, the Department of Interior, now has 30 days to issue a decision. Interior issued a statement this morning suggesting it could still block Willow. The statement says Interior has substantial concerns, even with the limits BLM proposes. The concerns include greenhouse gas emissions and impacts to wildlife and Alaska Native subsistence. Alaska's congressional delegation, the governor, and many North Slope leaders support Willow, saying it will bring needed jobs and revenue. Environmental groups are calling the project a climate bomb. The city and tribe of Nuiqsut also oppose the development. With the Willow news and a big decision about the proposed Pebble mine, it's been a busy week for federal decisions about Alaska resources, and it's only Wednesday. We've got Alaska Public Media DC correspondent Liz Ruskin on the line to discuss them. Liz, let's start with Pebble. We've reported that the Environmental Protection Agency used its veto authority over the Pebble mine. What does that even mean, though? I thought the Corps of Engineers already denied Pebble's wetlands permit.
You're right about that, and it's complicated because this goes beyond the permitting decision that the Corps makes about whether Pebble can get a permit. That's a wetlands permit to dump waste rocks into the river drainages upstream from Bristol Bay. The Corps already said no to that, and Pebble is appealing. But that's the permitting decision, and the EPA has special powers beyond that. Basically, the Clean Water Act of 1972 gives the EPA the authority to reverse a wetlands permitting decision made by the Corps. And according to the EPA, it can do this at any time before or after a permit is issued. And so this week, after considering it for about a decade, the EPA issued its veto, or in EPA speak, exercised its 404C authority.
Right, the 404C authority. So you're saying that this is in addition to the permit rejection that Pebble is appealing?
Right. Not only that, but it's also essentially telling Pebble, look, don't bother just tinkering with your mine plan. This decision essentially draws a big line around an area that includes the Pebble mine's proposed footprint, and it says you can't dump your rocks here.
Gotcha. I think the thing a lot of us are wondering because of all the ups and downs with Pebble and the reporting we've done over the years, is this really a final decision?
I know. It seems like we've reported many times that this is the final decision. But the answer is yes and no. It's final in that the EPA has gone through its entire process and issued its veto. Done. But as you can guess, Pebble is likely to appeal, and they say they're going to appeal. So I don't think we are done writing stories about Pebble.
Oh, okay. So us radio folks will probably still have to stumble over pronouncing molybdenum when we talk about this proposed copper, gold, and molybdenum mine.
Casey, you may have noticed I try to avoid the M word because I don't like tripping over the word molybdenum. Molybdenum. Even when you say it right, it sounds wrong.
It doesn't exactly roll off the tongue. Okay, let's switch regions and switch industries from mining to oil, and let's discuss Willow.
Yeah, and it's been a bit of a head spinner, especially for the anti-drilling side. They went from celebrating with their brethren who were trying to stop the Pebble Mine, and then they got bad news about Willow. But it's good news if you're ConocoPhillips, because they really, you know, they got most of what they wanted.
Right. But what happened today is not final when it comes to whether the Willow project will proceed, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. As our earlier story said, the Bureau of Land Management has identified its preferred alternative. That is BLM speak, actually federal agency speak. And now the Interior Secretary will decide whether to go with this preferred alternative, a slightly scaled down version of the project ConocoPhillips proposed. The Interior Department can scale it back further. They can reject it entirely. It seemed to me that Interior really made a point of saying today that BLM's selection of a preferred alternative is not the final word here. And Casey, as long as we're talking about not having a final word, opponents of drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, you remember that long-running controversy? They have not given up either. Just today, 55 mostly Democratic members of Congress announced a new bill that would reverse the 2017 decision opening the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge to oil drilling. This new bill would shut it back down again. So even when it does seem like a controversy is over, it can, you know, fire right back up again.
Okay, yeah. All the back and forth with that. That was Alaska Public Media's Washington, D.C. correspondent Liz Ruskin. You can find more of her reporting on Pebble, the Willow Project, even the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge at alaskapublic.org. Liz, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Casey.
The head of the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development unexpectedly resigned yesterday. As reported by the Alaska Beacon, Commissioner Tamika Ledbetter's resignation was announced in an email from the governor's office. A Dunleavy official said the resignation was effective immediately and Ledbetter is no longer a member of the administration. State legislators, including the chairs of the Senate and House Labor and Commerce Committees, said they were surprised by the announcement. Representative Jesse Sumner of Wasilla is chair of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. He said he had just spoken with Ledbetter a few days ago with no sign of an impending resignation. The statement from the governor's office did not say why Ledbetter resigned, and officials from the office were unable to immediately provide a copy of her resignation letter. Kathy Munoz replaces Ledbetter as acting commissioner. She's a Republican former state representative from Juneau who has worked as deputy labor commissioner since 2018. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Sitka chef is a semifinalist for a prestigious national award.
I would pick things that I think would survive the barge journey up here. So, like, you know, potatoes, carrots, onions, kale.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Genetic genealogy recently enabled Alaska state troopers to identify a human skull discovered 25 years ago. The trooper's Interior Alaska commander, Captain Eric Spitzer, says a pair of hunters found the skull along the Porcupine River near the Canadian border in September 1997. It was then delivered to the state medical examiner.
A cause of death was suspected of being the result of a bear mauling.
Spitzer says the identity of the bear attack victim remained unknown until last April, when a DNA sample from the skull was compared to a genetic genealogy database. That allowed investigators to home in on a relative and tentatively identify it as belonging to Gary Frank Southerden of New York.
The Alaska State Troopers contacted a suspected brother of Gary who submitted a DNA sample to the to Family Tree DNA, which subsequently resulted in a positive identification determining that they were indeed brothers.
Spitzer says troopers were also able to fill in the Alaska part of Southerden's story.
While speaking with family members, the Alaska State Troopers learned that Gary was dropped off in and around the area where the remains were found sometime in the early to mid-1970s, presumably to do some hunting. He has never been heard or seen by his family since then. A family biography and a grave marker for Southerden annotates he was lost somewhere in Alaska at the age of 25.
Spitzer says Southerden's brother was notified about the positive identification in late December and put in contact with the state medical examiner's office so the family could make arrangements to take possession of the remains. A federal appeals court has affirmed Metlakatla tribal members' right to fish in their traditional waters without state permits. But a new opinion issued Tuesday by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals leaves open the question of where exactly those traditional fishing grounds are. KRBD's Eric Stone reports.
Metlakatla Mayor Albert Smith welcomed the news.
First of all, it's something that we've been fighting for a long time. So we are extremely pleased to know that the Ninth Circuit so strongly supported our fishing rights.
Metlakatla's tribal government sued Governor Mike Dunleavy and other state officials in 2020. The tribe asserted that the 1891 federal law that created the Annette Islands Reserve, the only reservation in Alaska, guaranteed the tribe fishing rights throughout much of the southern panhandle. Congress passed the 19th century law after members of the tribe relocated from their previous home in Metlakatla, British Columbia, at the invitation of President Grover Cleveland. Senior U.S. District Court Judge John Sedgwick rejected the tribe's claim and dismissed the case the following year. Metlakatla appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which ruled in favor of the tribe last year in a 28-page decision. The opinion said that Congress guaranteed Metlakatla's tribal members the right to fish in their traditional waters despite the state's limited entry program, which limits the number of vessels targeting particular species of fish. The Ninth Circuit's three-judge panel initially ruled that Metlakatla tribal members had the right to fish in Districts 1 and 2, as laid out by the State Department of Fish and Game. Those encompass areas around Ketchikan's Revillagigedo Island and the southeastern shore of Prince of Wales Island. Smith, Metlakatla's mayor, says the tribe has records of its members bringing back fish from as far as the Aleutian Chain, but he acknowledges that the tribe's fishermen largely harvested from waters within a day's travel of the reserve at the southeastern tip of the state.
Time immemorial, we've been fishing all of those districts, 1 and 2, all the way down to, the border.
But the new opinion notes that the state of Alaska disputes the extent of the tribe's historical fishing grounds. It'll be up to the lower court to determine just how far the tribe's fishermen should be allowed to go. In its new order, the court also denied a request from the state of Alaska to reconsider its decision or put it before a larger Ninth Circuit panel. Alaska Department of Law spokesperson Patty Sullivan said in a statement that the Ninth Circuit panel, quote, continues to fundamentally misunderstand the history and legal framework in this case. She said the court should have sent the case back to the lower court for further arguments on the scope of the 1891 law. Sullivan said the state is reviewing the opinion and considering its next steps. Smith says Metlakatla is excited to continue with the case.
But we are ready for the next phase of this case and look forward to finally and permanently restoring our community's fishing rights.
The court's decision would allow tribal members to fish, quote, for personal consumption and ceremonial purposes as well as for commercial purposes. But details of how the decision might be implemented once the case concludes remain unclear. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
The city of Kodiak has outlined a list of capital improvement projects it hopes to fund this year. Among the city's top priorities and biggest expenses are $40 million worth of repairs for its biggest harbor. KMXD's Kirsten Dobrath walked the docks and has this report.
St. Herman Harbor is the larger of Kodiak's two boat harbors. Locals also call it Dog Bay, and the biggest vessels in Kodiak's commercial fishing fleet tie up there. But the harbor's existing infrastructure is from the early 80s, and it's in rough shape.
The sleeve's all that's keeping it from falling over at this point.
Kodiak's harbor master, Dave Johnson, points out corroded pilings that are patched together with Band-Aid-type metal casings. Pilings are pretty important. They're driven down into the bedrock of the seafloor, and the harbor's built around them.
You know, they have to withstand a lot of force. You know, you think of the size of all these boats, and, you know, we get 60, 70-mile-an-hour winds ripping through here, and all those mooring lines are pulling on these docks, which are pulling on these pilings, and that's what can bring them down if they've corroded through.
There are other problems, too. Some of the finger piers between boat slips are crooked and pulling apart. There are rusted-out electrical boxes. Other parts of the 40-year-old harbor are just really outdated. Johnson says it eats up manpower to keep up with the short-term projects, and it's expensive. Kodiak is one of the country's biggest commercial fishing ports, and he says getting an overhaul on the harbor started would be an economic boon.
This is like the largest commercial fishing fleet in the country, and they deserve a world-class facility, and this isn't it.
An overhaul of St. Herman Harbor is one of the city's proposed capital improvement projects for the upcoming fiscal year. It's also the most expensive item on Kodiak's wish list. The city estimates that it will cost roughly $40 million. But at a recent joint work session between the city and borough, Kodiak lobbyist Sebastian O'Kelly said right now might be the best time to get the project done, thanks to a recent influx of federal funding.
I do think there's a good opportunity with the Port Infrastructure Development Program. That program has been plussed up with significant additional dollars as a result of the bipartisan infrastructure law.
That program now has $662 million worth of federal grant funding available for waterfront development projects. O'Kelly said Kodiak might also be at an advantage because of the program's updated criteria that emphasizes funding for rural ports and harbors.
In the past, you know, a lot of that money went to places like Long Beach and New York and then within the state to Anchorage. So I think you guys are in a pretty good position.
The city still has to apply for grants, and Johnson says he knows other harbor masters in Alaska are eyeing that money too. But there could be a start date for the project on the horizon.
We've already got some preliminary designs. I'm really excited about them.
Johnson says his goal is for work to be underway by next year. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobroth.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
Time with friends means the world for kids, and the same goes for kids at heart. Connecting with friends and loved ones matters because Alaskans are better together. Boost your power to protect yourself and those around you by keeping up to date on all recommended vaccines, including an annual flu shot, or any boosters recommended by your provider. Visit vaccinate.alaska.gov to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Here's the latest medal count at the Arctic Winter Games in Alberta as of this afternoon. Team Alaska has now collected 65 of those ulu-shaped medals, 21 gold, 23 silver, and 21 bronze. In the last day, Alaska has moved from fourth to second place in the total number of ulus. Yukon Territories is in the lead with 78. Alberta North is in third place with 51 medals. Colton James Paul of Kipnuk has won 3 gold medals in Arctic sports for the triple jump, the 2-foot high kick, and the Alaska high kick. In biathlon skiing, Elias Watson of Anchorage also picked up 2 ulus, along with Gemma McGrew of Anchorage in the biathlon snowshoe competition. And in cross-country skiing, Mia Cam Magruder of Anchorage also took 2 gold medals. Well, there are about a dozen Chilkat weavers in Juneau this week. They're working 5 or more hours a day trying to finish up intricate child-sized robes that will be worn by local children when they dance a ceremonial dance. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry has their story.
The weavers are apprentices of local weaver Lily Hope. During the pandemic, she offered classes virtually.
If you say Chilkat robe, raise your hand.
What if you say both? Should we raise our hands?
But now, they're together in person. The children's robes they're working on are detailed and time-consuming. But it takes 2 years or more to make an adult-sized one. so the smaller ones are both a practical consideration and also really special. They'll be worn by local children at the end of this workshop. There are about a dozen weavers in the room laughing and joking with each other while their hands are tangled up in yellow, blue, black, and white yarn, the traditional colors of Chilkat weaving. The robes they're working on are at different stages, but most are nearly done. Sakoon Dunedin Jackson is here from Alberta, Canada. She started her robe from home by watching Lily Hope's videos. She spun the yarn and hung it on the loom and began weaving. But on a road trip last summer, she got in an accident, and the blanket, as well as everything in her camper van, burned in the wreck.
The reason I was able to participate at all is because it's Jody's daughter. She gifted me her auntie's yarns, who had passed. So it is absolutely a project of love and support of this entire community.
She was able to restart the robe and thinks she'll finish in time for the first dance.
It's not like joining a crochet group. Right? Yeah. It's more. There's culture and there's the spiritual aspect of it. I think it makes it, it's what changes it from art to a living being.
The design for her robe is from Hope's late mother, Clarissa Rizal. It was the last child-size robe she designed. It doesn't have clan affiliations. She wanted to use a design that was, quote, open source, so that children with any clan affiliation could dance in them. Gunasha Karen Togg started weaving in 1984, but she put it on hold after having five children. The robe she's working on is her first big weaving piece, and she's glad to be in good company for it.
You get stuck like on a circle. You know, there's so many people to ask. You know. Plus, Lily does the videos, but still it's nice to interact with all the other ladies because you learn little tricks of the trade.
She plans to have her grandson dance in the robe, which shows the face of a fisherman and his two grandchildren in profile, turned towards him in the center. Growing the number of Chilkat weavers is important, Hope said in an earlier interview.
Over the last 120 years, fewer than a dozen Chilkat blanket makers or robe weavers existed at any given point. We are changing that story this week.
All these weavers send a message about the status of Chilkat weaving today.
My goal really is to let the world know that we're still making Chilkat robes, we're still weaving our history, we're still telling our stories. Yeah, we're still here alive and well.
The robes will be on display at the Juneau Douglas City Museum until the end of February. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumery.
A Sitka chef is one of four Alaskan semifinalists for the prestigious James Beard Award. Renee Trafton opened Beak in 2017 and has made the best of her unique situation, creating award-winning cuisine on an island with some amazing benefits and many practical challenges. KCAW's Catherine Rose reports.
When I meet Renee Trafton on a Monday, it's a day off at Beak, so the restaurant is empty, and we have our choice to sit at one of a handful of mismatched tables. She chooses a black and white striped rectangular table in the corner of her restaurant, next to a 100-year-old wooden piano. She says table 8 is where most people sit if they have a choice, next to the window where there's a slight view of the water.
One of the times Mary Peltola came in, she sat right here.
What did Mary Peltola order?
She got the cod tips. Okay. It was her second time coming in. The first time she got them with her daughter, and I don't usually serve them at lunch, but she asked, and I had them, so.
She opened Beak 6 years ago, just before the start of the summer season.
It was such a, like, tenuous-seeming endeavor, and many people like try to open restaurants and they fail, and I've just been working really hard, and to get this type of like national recognition is just unbelievably amazing.
Trafton started cooking for friends at Oberlin College. She was a dinner cook there for 2 years. When she graduated, she considered culinary school, but it was expensive, so she decided to get some experience first, just to get a taste of the profession. She moved to New York and ended up working for a couple of Michelin star restaurants.
And it was a really formative experience. It was really exciting to learn about fine dining and all the many, many rules of it and sort of the focus that the chefs out there have. And I think I've definitely taken that focus and trained it on the ingredients I have like available to me here.
Trafton says in the last 6 years in her own place, her culinary voice has strengthened. and she's learned to adapt to the challenges of operating a restaurant on an island in Southeast Alaska.
In New York City, you can call at 10 o'clock at night, and at like 8 o'clock in the morning, you have whatever produce you want. And here it's a week out. So when I was designing my menu from the beginning, I would pick things that I think would survive the barge journey up here. So like, you know, potatoes, carrots, onions, kale, kind of the heartier items.
While she can't get all of her produce locally, she has access to the freshest fish imaginable, and her menu centers around it. Over the years, she's been able to cultivate relationships with fishermen. She can have 1,500 pounds of salmon, halibut, black cod, and even gooseneck barnacles in cold storage, and knows exactly who caught every pound and where it came from. With that, she's able to take barge potatoes and kale to new heights.
I can really transform them from something that's, you know, something you just buy at the grocery store. It's, you know, not that exciting, but with like technique and time and a lot of effort, the transformation from like the raw food to like dinner is, for me, it's always been like a magical transformation. And I think that that's what makes Beak really special, is how much thoughtfulness we put into our food here.
The James Beard Foundation this year is looking for chefs that set high standards with their culinary skill, who also contribute positively to their communities and make efforts to help create a sustainable work culture. That was Trafton's goal from the beginning. Beak is gratuity-free, and it was always important to her to make sure there wasn't pay disparity between servers and kitchen staff. She says she's always tried to hone a culture of respect and positivity in her kitchen, and music helps too.
It just kind of lightens the mood because, you know, you got a zillion things to do and the orders are coming in, everything's happening. But if you're singing along to the radio, it kind of, like, it makes the team feel more united and lighthearted, so you don't get bogged down. It keeps the vibe energetic and happy instead of frustrated. Yeah, being upbeat is, like, super important for me. And I think that is not generally the case in kitchens, but this is my kitchen, so I want to be happy.
As for the future of Beak, Trafton is excited to be busier than ever following the announcement from the James Beard Foundation. But she says her goal isn't to turn a lot of tables. She just wants to have people over for dinner and make them food with thought and care. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
Renee Trafton is one of 20 semifinalists from the Northwest and Pacific region, including Anchorage restaurateur Lael Fairbairn of Locally Grown Restaurants, Anchorage chef Nathan Bentley from Altura Bistro, and Juno's Bo Schooler of In Boca al Lupo. The James Beard Foundation will announce the top five nominees from each category in late March. And finally tonight, a correction to a story Tuesday about Cook Inlet gas. Gas supply is expected to fall below half of all demand by 2033, not 2023. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Eric Stone in Ketchikan, Kirsten Dobroth in Kodiak, Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Yvonne Crumry in Juneau, and Catherine Rose in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. There are many ways to support your local public media station. Donate now and arrange to make a planned gift as a bequest. Your legacy will stretch from today to many tomorrows. Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.